This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like a super fan. A super fan of painting. Because since we've been doing this podcast, I've realised, like, I think there is a constant thread. Even though we have had many different kinds of artists and different guests, there is always a thread of painting through our show.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting. There's something about painting that keeps coming back for me personally, because I just love everything that painting can do and can be and can mean. Like, I know it's the same for you, I think, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. But I think there is kind of a hierarchy in the art world that painting's like the favourite child, and all the other mediums are the less favoured siblings. But I see all art across the board. I love all my children the same. But I absolutely am drawn to painting, and I'm definitely drawn to the materiality of painting, how we make up painting, what materials people use.
Yeah, and today we are going to be speaking to two incredible guests, the first of which we have on the line right now. And she's an amazing, amazing British painter and also performance artist. And her performances...
Multidisciplinary, yes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And her performances really involve this idea of painting, but taking it to a completely new place, which is incredibly exciting, whilst also relating to a lot of art history, kind of direct response in many ways.
Absolutely.
So I'm very excited. We would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Adelaide Demoa.
Hello. Well, a nice introduction. Thank you very much. Checked in the post.
Hi, Adelaide.
Hello.
Where in the world are you, Adelaide?
I'm in Abbey Wood in southeast London.
Oh, cool.
All right. Nice. And do you have a studio there? Do you work from home and you've got separate places?
Both. I have. So basically, I'm with a studio complex called Beaux Arts, and my apartment's upstairs, and my studio is downstairs in the complex, in the same complex. So I'm really lucky to have that, because during these COVID times, I've still been able to come down to the studio and work.
Oh, that's so good.
Oh, that's great.
That's so good. Well, I've been doing loads of research on you, and the thing that comes up constantly is, well, something that I'm really drawn to is your performances, and watching these incredible performances where you're so empowered and you're so present and strong, and it feels very spiritual. It feels like there's a lot of what you draw on in your work is spirituality, and the spirits of your ancestors come into your practice a lot.
Yes, I definitely agree with that, and it is almost a spiritual experience for me, in that in the run up to any performance I do, I have a set routine that involves fasting for 24 hours, involves a lot of meditation and preparation before I even hit the stage. And in addition to that, there is a direct drawing on my ancestors. So I do a meditation where I'm directly calling on a specific ancestor, not because I know her or know anything about her, but just because I've been obsessed with her image since I found it. And it's the image itself is one of a very powerful woman. So for me to embody what I imagine to be her power is really helpful to me, and it helps me to get into what I call the flow state during the performance.
Wow, so you fast. What I mean that I mean, and does that, as you go into performance, does that give you a certain focus? Or I mean, if I didn't eat for a day, I'd be really shaky up there. I'd be nervous anyway, but then I'd be shaky. But does that help you really streamline your thinking and your energy?
Definitely, 100%. Because I mean, I've been doing intermittent fasting for a few years now, but I did notice that any time I was in a fasted state, I felt more focused. So it then made sense to me once I started doing performance in 2016-17 that I do that in a fasted state, just because I just feel more able to really focus on the task at hand. And I don't know, somehow I just feel that it takes me to an altered state of consciousness, especially when I'm adding in the extra element of meditation, which takes you somewhere else as well.
Wow. And there's definitely a strong thread of kind of feminist politics within what you do. And I know that you mentioned that when you're connecting to your ancestors, you mentioned the pronoun she. So can you speak a bit about that kind of approach as well?
I suppose I would describe myself as a feminist, and I'm part of a collective called the Intersectional Feminist Collective, so I would describe myself as an intersectional feminist.
Yeah.
All of those things are very important to me.
Can you explain what intersectional feminism is?
Yeah, of course. It was a term coined, I think, in the 80s, and it's used to differentiate and allow for space to think about other women's experiences when talking about feminism, right? And when fighting the fight when it comes to feminism. So, for example, with me, I'm a black woman. So when I'm engaging in conversations about feminism, it's important to look at the especially in the Western world, it's important to look at the intersection, the space where race and gender intersect, to talk about feminism from my perspective. Because otherwise, if you don't do that, you're in danger of leaving out people, whether that is people of colour, whether that is trans people, whether that is gay people. You are really in danger of leaving marginalised groups out of the conversation if you don't allow for space for their voices to come into the conversation.
Right. So you then set up, you're one of the founders of this collective.
Yes. We literally just formed in February of this year on what we call Galentine's Day, February 14th at my house. We didn't start off with the intention of forming a collective. We started off with the intention of doing an exhibition, because we were four women, plus a writer, actually, who were very passionate about Artemisia Gentileschi. Her show was opening, is now open. So we were discussing doing an exhibition in response to the Artemisia show, because all of us work with the body and the figure, the female figure, in very distinct, different ways. And when we had that meeting and we ended up talking about the exhibition, then somehow we ended up saying, this sounds very much like we're talking about doing this exhibition. We're also talking about continuing it. So it feels to me very much like a collective, because I'm already a founding member of another collective, which was founded 5 years ago, 2015. And so it made sense to just decide to say, well, this is a collective, because essentially we're working together and we have the same aims and objectives. So we might as well make something of this and see what we can give back as well.
That's great.
Wow.
And you mentioned this idea of the body being a very important part of your work, and also what connected you to those other people in the collective. But if you think of art history, like, there were so many sort of important moments and artworks that I personally love and have resonated with me over the years. Artists like Anna Mendieta, even Yoko Ono, like her kind of cut piece, Janine Anthony, And then obviously a few kind of very well-known male artists, even like Yves Klein or David Hammons. But can you speak a bit about the influence of art history on what you've on what you've created?
The influence of art history on my work, sure. I mean, you've mentioned a number of my major influences there, actually, all in one fell swoop. making the job very easy for me. But I suppose when it comes to thinking about the way that I currently work, I got very excited by Yves Klein, David Hammons, and Anna Mendieta, first and foremost. And so the very first performance I did in 2017, using my body in the way that I started using it from that point, was a direct response to Yves Klein's 1960 Anthropometries performance. So that was a direct feminist response to that work. Well, it was more so a direct feminist response to the critique of that work, which was that what he was doing was creating a passive female body which was ripe for objectification by the male gaze. And to me, that was a very, very interesting response, given that this is a performance where you have a clothed male dressed in a very smart dinner suit and a fully clothed audience, all in black tie and evening gowns, with an orchestra playing one note. And then you have a group of very beautiful, very young white ladies who are all naked, and he's directing them all to cover their bodies in this gorgeous blue paint and then make this beautiful artwork. And so for me, watching videos of that performance was kind of awkward and uncomfortable. And then reading that critique hit home to me. So creating a response from my perspective was interesting to me, and quite, I want to say, exciting and empowering in a way, in a weird way. And then from there, one of the performance that is closest to my heart really is the Into the Mind of the Colonizer performance I performed for the first time last year at Open Space Contemporary. And that performance was directly influenced in a massive way by Yoko Ono's 1965 cut piece. And that one, where Yoko Ono is talking about violence against the female body, I was talking about my body specifically was a physical embodiment or representation of Africa, and the violence against Africa during the scramble for Africa with the 1884-85 Berlin Conference, in which the whole of Africa was divided up among Europeans by Europeans, with not a single African present. And the violence that continued to be perpetrated against Africa from that point on, and which still reverberates to this day. And so by me acting as a stand-in, and the performance involved me actually speaking the words of the colonizer, which were from books that I found going back to, these are out-of-print books, 204 out-of-print books that I found in 2018 that go all the way back to the mid-1600s. They're all digitized, but they speak specifically from the perspective of people who were actively involved in the colonization process, or project, as I like to call it. And some of it is directions, how to colonize a people, how to subjugate a people, their thoughts on the natives. And so the performance involved me speaking these words and then inviting the audience to come and cut my clothes off. And the cutting is the Yoko Ono's Yoko Ono reference. Yes.
And actually, there was something in that performance which you know, took it to a whole other place. And it was very much this idea of your body being covered in paint. And then, you know, once the clothes have been cut, you know, you then start to create an artwork that's beyond the performance, that becomes this kind of physical artwork on the floor, you know, on the paper. So can you speak a bit about how important materials are to your practice?
So important, especially when it comes to these kinds of performances where I'm using paint on my body. I experimented so much with different types of paint.
Right.
And I found that the one that works best for me is Winsor & Newton water mixable oil paint, because that it's the least irritating and it's the easiest to get off. And I want to use oil paint because it's archival, hello. So, the water mixable oil paint.
Oh, yeah.
And also I had I did have a conversation with some scientists who informed me that the water mixable oil paint is the best thing to use for those types of performances. But even then, after some time of continuing to do that, it starts to take a toll on the skin. So from the perspective of my health and from the perspective of the longevity of the work, the Winsor & Newton water mixable is the best for those kinds of performances. But also with the colonizer performance, though, I added, I actually used food dye. I mixed food dye to make the paint look like blood.
Ah.
Otherwise, it didn't look very blood-like. So I used food dye to make the paint look like blood. So I'm very experimental with my materials. Obviously, ultimately, it depends on the thing that I'm trying to do, whether it's performance or whether it's my studio work, as to, you know, what materials I will use.
Wow. Well, you just talked about, you asked a scientist, because that triggers me, because you had quite an unconventional route into art. You were studying biology first, applied biology, and during that time you studied Da Vinci and the human form and human proportions. And now I find it really fascinating that through art, finding your art practice, that it is all about the figure. And I think your early work was traditional figuration, but now it's about you, and you describe your own body as like a living paintbrush. And I find that kind of, from your history of biology and now your work as an artist now, that line feels quite enticing to me.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I suppose at university, my two favorite subjects would have been definitely anatomy and physiology, and then molecular genetics. Those, like, I would geek out on those mm-hmm. subjects. But painting and drawing was something that I had done since I was a kid. I just always had a passion for it. I don't think I was ever really that great at it, but I just always had a passion for painting and drawing, and specifically the body and the figure. So for me, it was a natural progression. It kind of feels that way now. At the time when I was sort of switching, it didn't feel that natural. It was kind of a painful transition. But now that I'm here looking back, it feels like that was the only way it could go, really. And then from there, who knows? Because I'm experimenting with all sorts of different things now. Still using the body to create work, but maybe breaking the boundaries of the body in terms of what ends up on the canvas or on the paper.
Oh, really? And talking about the palette you use, you use quite a limited choice of colours. I think I've read that you use black and gold. These are quite a consistent palette of oil paints that you use.
Yeah, well, it depends. For one particular series, so for the Genesis series of work, that was 2018, I was specifically using black and gold because of the subject matter, the whole series of work, and for that particular exhibition. But and the black was a direct reference to race, and the gold was a direct reference to the Gold Coast, which is present day Ghana. Used to be British Gold Coast, used to be a British possession. But my palette is limited in that I generally tend to, when I get obsessed with a colour, I'll stick with that colour for a long time. So so it's been blue, it's been red.
So you've had your periods, like Picasso's blue period, we've got Adelaide's gold period.
But now I'm stuck on, I'm doing a lot of cyanotypes at the moment. So I'm obsessed with the kind of Prussian blue that you get with cyanotypes. And also I am doing these, this is a whole new series of work that I'm obsessed with at the moment, which is I'm calling it pure joy. It came out of lockdown. It came out of all of that negativity, something positive with really crazy bright colours that I was never comfortable working with before.
Oh, cool.
Like what?
Like hot pink, cobalt yes. blue, purples, just so juicy. So, yeah, that's where I am right now.
That's great. Can you just talk about what a cyanotype is? Would you describe then cyanotype?
Oh, cyanotypes, yes. So a cyanotype is like it's a very old kind of image development technique using chemicals. So you mix these two chemicals. These days you can just buy cyanotype part A and part B. It's potassium ferricyanide, that's how you say it. Mm-hmm. Potassium ferricyanide and ferric ammonium citrate. And you can buy them as a package. You mix part A, part B, and then you paint the surface. You can paint anything from paper to canvas to eggshells to fabric. And you paint in the... It has to be in the absence of UV light. You let it dry in the dark, preferably overnight, so it's completely dry. And then you use negatives and expose the... it doesn't have to be negative. It could be an object, whatever shape you want to get onto the paper. And you expose it to UV mm-hmm. light for a certain period of time, and then you get this beautiful Prussian blue and it image. And it can be... It depends on the type of paper you use, if you use white paper or if you're using paper that's been treated with dye or something like what I use, as to what kind of highlights you get.
Wow, so it's like a shadow that's left behind, or like it's like photographic paper, I guess.
Yeah, basically, you can turn anything into photographic paper, essentially. It's a kind of a simplified way of looking at it. But it's very old. I mean, this is a technique that has been around since the 1800s. And it's where the term blueprint came from. You know, blueprint, in architecture. Yeah, that's where it came from. So,
go. Well, I love the science behind it then. There's a passion in your voice when you're talking about it. point of view.
I'm really into this idea of the, like, Winsor & Newton. You were talking about how the scientists, you know, get in touch with the artists as well. And I know that they developed this new type of paint that can really, like, keep the brilliance of the colour and the kind of light fastness of the colour. I think it's like a new series of cadmium-free oil colours. Is that something that you've been using yourself then for these new works?
No, not yet, but... I have been speaking to those scientists about basically creating, because I'm always experimenting with different things, so I'm going to be sending them some samples so that they can test it to see the longevity of the work. They've got some special machine there. But I have been using their varnishes and Liquitex varnishes as well, which are really good in terms of longevity and light fastness. But the good thing about cyanotypes is you don't actually need that. But I use the varnishes and things for the other works where I'm using pigment, because I use a lot of dry pigment. And that's where actually the David Hammond's reference comes in, actually circling back to references and influences. Yeah. David Hammond's... So essentially, a lot of the body print work that I do, I use dry pigment and grease, and that technique comes from David Hammond's. Well, I read that's how David Hammond's produced his body print series of work. And mm-hmm. when I saw his body prints, I was obsessed. I was like, how did he do it like that? And I dug and dug and dug, and I found out that's how he did it. So then I kind of developed my own way of doing it. But yeah, it requires a lot of varnish to set it in place.
Wow.
Yeah, his work always makes me think a lot at points, like the Turin Shroud. You know, like the way that fabric was embedded with Christ.
Exactly.
There's that energy in the work, and yeah.
Exactly. That's why
Rob's going to like this, because we know that your art hero is Frida Kahlo, is your, like, long-running heroine hero, and for Rob it's the same for him. I feel like you, totally. You two can bond over that.
Love her.
obsessed. I literally, a friend of mine just gave me her a really gorgeous book the other day, which is her diaries.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
Yes, I have it here. I was talking to Russell about it the other day.
Oh my God, it's beautiful. It's so gorgeous. It's just one of those kinds of books that you just... Another one of my obsessions is books. I have a massive collection of books. But yeah, that book is literally one of my favourites. But yeah, it's because of... Frida is who made me fall in love with art in the way that I did, in the very specific way that I did. Not just in terms of figuration, but also in terms of her expression of herself, her telling the truth about herself, about her life, about her experiences, about her pain, you know. And I was shown that from quite a young age, from like 14 at school. And from that point on, I just basically tried to be Frida. Every time I made a painting, I was trying to be Frida. I literally have a painting of like one of my very early paintings, which was like my reimagining of the two Fridas, but it was me and my dad. That's how I was obsessed with her.
It's really interesting because I connected with Frida at a very similar age when I was like 13, 14. And I think it's actually the work that got me so into painting. It was seeing some of those paintings like My Birth and the Two Fridas and just the way that painting can transform, you know, real human experience and emotions, but somehow it becomes something other. And I think that's why I love oil paint so much too.
Exactly. Like she, for me, embodied the power of oil paint, just painting full stop. Mm. She embodied the potential for the power of painting for me in such a profound way that I think, I don't know, maybe it could be potentially life-changing. If I went back in time to 13, 14 and hadn't discovered Frida, would I still end up being an artist? I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe a different artist.
Wow.
Maybe just gone to science. I don't know. But for me, it was that serious for me. My love of Frida. Yeah.
That's so amazing. So what are you working towards at the minute, Adelaide? What's like, you seem to have kept busy during lockdown and finding new exciting things to work on. What can we look forward to next?
Loads of stuff. So I'm working on like three different bodies of work at the moment. But the main project for me is my the continuation of my Confronting Colonization project, the first iteration of which was the Into the Mind of the Colonizer performance. So that is going to be expanded over the next couple of years. And then at the same time, I'm really pushing this cyanotype work. And just stuff comes up all the time. Fairs, art fairs, exhibitions. At the moment, I'm in Flowers Gallery. It's just opened today, actually. The gallery of these small, these beautiful exhibition. And also at the RWA in Bristol, the open exhibition. Just opened. I'm an academician there, so there's
yes. You were the first ever black artist to become an academician in 2019, right?
Apparently, yeah. I'm not entirely sure. I don't know that there's any way of being able to check all the way back as far back as the RWA has been open, but yeah, apparently that is the case.
It's the Royal West of England Academy, but is that aligned with the Royal Academy in London?
Yes. So basically, you've got the Royal Academy schools, and then the RWA is the only regional Royal Academy in the country, and it's in Bristol. So yeah.
Oh wow! And you're an academician there. That is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise to me as well.
That's major. So we ask every artist that comes on or every guest two very important questions, which I hope you prep for. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, if you could steal nicely any work of art in the world, what would it be and why?
I know the obvious answer is going to be the Two Fridas by Frida Kahlo. Right, that's just too obvious.
Yes,
it's just too obvious.
Where is it though? Where in the world is it?
I have no idea right now, but the answer that immediately came to mind, because I've been thinking about this for a long time, because I've heard some of your other interviews, so I've been thinking about this for a long time, and for me, it has to be all of the Seagram murals, all of them.
Really?
Yes. I was at the opening in 2008 at the Tate, right? Yeah. And I sat in front of, I sat in that room, and the feeling that I had from those works was, I don't even know how to describe it. It was like a spiritual ecstatic experience that I've only ever really had during meditation sessions.
Right.
Wow.
So
you've been a fan of Rothko before that, obviously because of the colour and everything, but was Rothko someone who was on your radar?
Yes. I mean, it was on my radar, but I'd never seen the work in real life. So just looking at it on screen doesn't compare to seeing it in real life. Looking at it on screen, there's not an inkling that it would do that to you, that it would do that to you emotionally, physically. Just, it was like an immersive, beautiful, meditative experience. And I've never had that with any other piece of artwork.
Wow. And that's at the Tate Modern now, for anybody who's listening. I think it's...
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Yeah, I think it's a permanent exhibition. Yeah. And there was... He made them for the Seagram's hotel, or is it
exactly.
a lounge? And then suddenly he didn't want to... They didn't have enough money, or they weren't going to do something, and he just took them away... And they never went up there, or did they go up?
Yeah.
What's the
no,
story?
No, they didn't. Apparently, they didn't. They never went up. And then he ended up, I think, towards the end of his life, then they got somehow ended up with the Tate. I don't know why they didn't end up going up. I suspect maybe they just didn't end up having the money or something, probably something like that.
Mm. I think they fell out. I think he went there and he went to lunch there and he went, I don't want my work to be around these people.
That's
I think it was a bit of
yeah, there was something.
Snobbery
oh, really?
With him. Yeah. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I think he was a bit sassy with it and was like, absolutely not, actually. I'm here now. No.
I don't like you people. You can't have my work.
So the other question we ask every guest is a perfect one for you because of your incredible detailed knowledge of different colours. But what is your favourite colour?
Again, the obvious answer, well, not obvious to you, but obvious to me, because ever since I was a child, my favourite colour was always red. And anyone who asked me, what's your favourite colour, I would always say red. Mm. When they said why, I didn't understand why. It just was red. It was just the most pleasing colour to me emotionally. It just the most pleasing colour to my eye, and it just made me feel the most powerful. However, since I've become an artist... I go through different phases and I have different obsessions. So at one point, I was obsessed with the blue. That ultramarine blue was like my life. I wanted to surround myself with just blue. Other times it's been black. I always go back to the red, though. Always go back to the red. But right now, it's that hot pink.
Is it?
Mm. It makes me feel some kind of way. It makes me feel happy.
So cool.
Positive. It's an incredibly positive colour. And it's this colour that actually... Michael Craig Martin, who's an amazing artist, his favourite colour is... it's a magenta, isn't it?
Yeah, it's magenta, yeah.
Which is kind of very similar to hot pink. And he says, for some reason, artworks really work hung on the hot pink wall or on this magenta pink wall. For some reason, all artwork pops and it doesn't take it away from the work. It actually enhances the experience.
That's interesting. I've never heard... I'm going to have to try that. I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
I think he took you. I think he took it so far that he actually, when he curated the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition, he painted the entire Royal Academy in that colour on the walls. And it was really controversial because some artists like didn't think it was going to work, but apparently it looked really spectacular.
Mm. Ooh, interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's quite a bold choice. I'm really into this idea of like hot pink as being a response somehow to this past year we've been in. You know, like it's almost like we sort of need these vibrant, bright, intense colours now for like our soul or something. Like,
seriously, yeah. It's like food.
Yes.
It really is. It's like food. Colours, to me, can feel like food. So I feel almost as if when I come into the studio and I'm working with particular colours, it can really change my mood differently, like in a very serious way. So when I come into the studio and I lay down yes. a canvas on the floor and I throw on some hot pink and then the purple and that cobalt blue to get, oh, all of a sudden, even if it's dark outside, I feel alive. I feel better in myself. I feel centered.
So brilliant. Yeah. It's also interesting to me, the power of painting. And I feel like we need painting now, you know, as a response to all of these turbulent times we've been in. And I don't just mean like figurative painting. I mean all kinds of painting. And I think you're a really brilliant example of somebody that's taking painting to a completely, you know, yes, it's linked to history, but you're also doing something that's new and of this moment and, you know, your presence on earth right now, if you know what I mean, like some kind of record of it. I find it incredibly inspiring.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you. That means a lot. Thanks.
Well, we love you, Adelaide. Thank you so much for coming on. This has been incredible.
I'm so happy about your practice. Windsor and Newton, you know, introduced us to your work as well, because that's how we actually heard about you in the first instance. And it's been such a joy to explore. And I can't wait to actually meet you at some point.
That would be nice. I've actually met you before, Russell.
Oh, yeah?
Well, yes. Very briefly. Yeah. Very briefly at... it was the Tate, it was this event, this weird kind of event where they hired out the whole of the top floor of, and they had that newsreader coming to present the things. And
it was a quiz, it was the Tate quiz.
That quiz thing, yeah. That was like a year or two ago or something.
Was you on the winning table?
No, I wasn't. Not happy about that.
Same.
I was so gutted.
Yeah, we failed miserably as well. Yeah, I know, me too.
And we tried so hard. Oh, well.
Well, it's nice to speak to you again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Adelaide. I've loved every minute. And looking forward to seeing your next exhibition.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye.
All right. All the best.
Have a nice day.
Bye.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So Rob, that was amazing. Adelaide Demoa was incredible then. We've got another guest coming on now who is someone that you know very, very well.
Yeah, Huddy is an artist that I actually collect. I have one of his amazing figurative paintings.
I first
met him via his dad, of all people, because I actually represent his dad in the gallery, at Carl Friedman Gallery, because Huddy is related to Billy Childish, the incredible painter. Mm-hmm. But the really cool thing is, Huddy is an amazing painter in his own right. And I've been seeing his work develop over the past 3-4 years in the studio and fell crazy in love with everything that he's doing. I think think his self-portraits are just extraordinary. And he's a very different artist to Adelaide, actually, which is partly why we wanted to talk to him, because of this idea of painting now and what it means, and particularly oil painting, which is, you know, a very specific medium. So I'm very excited to be introducing to Talk Art, Huddy Hamper.
Thank you very much. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Where are you? Are you in Kent?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm at my parents. I've been down here over this month of the second lockdown.
Yes, of course. How old are you?
I am 20. I'm going to be 21 next week.
Oh my God. And well, we're not in full lockdown then, so you can sort of see a few people, hopefully, a few of your friends.
I think so, yeah. It's confusing with all these different rules and whatnot, but
I know.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll work something out.
Are you in Kent at the moment?
I am, yeah. I went down to my dad for this.
Because Kent's really annoying at the moment. It's gone into tier three, so I don't know
if I know.
Can see many people. But, yeah.
I think that's your fault though, Rob, to be honest.
It's all my fault. Everything's my fault.
Is he the super spreader?
Yes. One person has done it.
I'm definitely not a super spreader. So, Huddy, you're currently studying at Slade, is that right?
Yes, I am. I've got 4-5 months left or something. I finish in May, which is going to be strange.
Yeah. Wow, how has that been? I mean, what has that been like during lockdown? Have you done everything on Zoom?
Yes, yeah, which has its ups and downs.
What's the ups?
The ups is you can, like, I can be down in Kent, I can be at my parents and do meetings online and things. I don't have to actually travel up to London. The downs are the fact that I don't really like doing things online.
Yeah, right, okay, that's quite a big down, yeah.
Yeah, but it is really handy, you know, if you've got to be somewhere else or do something, and you can just do it on your laptop.
Yeah. Have you got a studio down in Kent, or do you go into your dad's?
I paint in my dad's studio down in Kent.
Oh,
which
wow.
is so lucky to be able to have, you know. I feel so sorry for people that have, like, you know, especially over that first lockdown, I was able to do so much work, which was the upside for the lockdown for me, I think, was that I really was able to focus on painting and I did some woodcuts and sort of like without any social distractions, and have the opportunity to, well, have the access to a studio. You know, kids that don't have that, I think it must have been really tough.
Yeah. What was it like growing up with your dad being like a well-known practicing artist, and was you surrounded by art as well as your dad's work growing up and seeing other artists practice and meeting other artists? What was your kind of childhood like?
Well, my very young childhood wasn't so much like that. I remember, I think I was about 10 when my dad had his big break at the ICA, and that's when I first sort of started to, you know, sort of started to realise, like, I went to the show and, you know, sat around and watched people interview him. But it's just always been the way it is. So it sounds a bit silly, but, you know, I've never really known it to be any different. He doesn't really collect art. He's got, it's mostly family art. So in my room, I've got one of his paintings. I've got one of my uncle's, something my uncle made when he was at Slade. We've got my grandmother's pots in the house, and he's actually got a Schmidt Rutloff that his German gallery gave him for his birthday last year. I think that's about
cool.
for art, yeah, which is really, really nice. A woodcut.
Oh, I remember. I know your grandmother's pots. They're cats, aren't they? They're ceramic, like, jugs, but they've got like cat faces and.
Yeah, they're really cool.
Yeah. They're great.
I think I saw White Columns in New York had them. Wasn't
she had a big solo exhibition there. I'm not sure if what the connection with my dad was with that.
I think your dad also did a show there. But her name's June, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. She passed away over the lockdown.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh,
I didn't
I'm
know
sorry.
That.
She's very old. She's 92. Same age as the Queen.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, not coronavirus.
Work in your house. That's so nice.
Yeah, there's lots of pots and things around, and hopefully, I think there's an idea, or I don't know, it'd be nice if someone did an exhibition at some point soon.
That's it, we'll put that out there in the world. That's got
but
to
also,
happen
your
now.
Your family put together a book, didn't they, of June Lewis's pots? I think it's
yes.
called June's Pots, and you should check it out if you
June
haven't
Hamper,
seen
isn't
before.
It, yeah.
Yeah, it's
no,
June
No, it's
Hamper.
June Lewis.
Oh, it's June Lewis. Okay. Oh, yeah, it is June Lewis, because I remember seeing the book and thinking the font looked like the font of John Lewis.
Exactly, yes.
It does look just like, yeah.
So how did you find your way into the mediums that you're using? Because your relationship between the materials and your practice are quite similar to your dad's, but yet you have this other language that goes through the work.
Well, on the first point, I think I probably started doing oil paints when I was about 9, and I did art club after school with my dad when I was a kid, and it was he used to tell me that he can't do many things, but this is one thing he can do and one thing he can teach me how to do, which I always thought was quite nice. So he taught me how to draw, showed me, you know, just really simple things, like, with, you know, he used to paint at my grandmother's on Sundays, and sometimes I'd go and do a painting there, and, you know, he'd show me, oh, look, this is a, you know, you don't want to scrub the paint in, you want to put it on like this, or, you know, you want to use the brush in a certain way, kind of like quite straightforward, simple stuff.
It's like so the materiality and the way it's all linked. So the way that you use oil paint, I mean, you obviously learnt, you were saying, from your dad just then, the skills, but is that something that you really feel like you're constantly exploring?
I do it quite a lot, so I guess I am exploring it. I think there's a certain, nowadays especially, there's a certain idea that you, and when you're younger as well, to kind of like, oh, you need to try, you know, you need to try everything in very little detail, which is kind of a shame, you know, like on my foundation or whatever. I did like a 2-year foundation, and there was kind of, there's not really any focus. And I think people, and you know, it's great to have a breadth of skills, but there definitely is a lack of focus. And I find I have been able to focus a lot on just doing painting, especially oils, you know, and that's the only way you learn how to do anything, really, I think, is just by doing it for a very, very long time. And this idea that I think people that are going to go to art school and, you know, after 3 years or 4 years, they're going to come out being a painter or being an artist is just ridiculous. I mean, it's like, I think it's a life's work, really, like any kind of.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm. What is it about oil paint, though, for you that is your medium of choice, really?
Well, oil paint is just, I mean, if oil paint is the best paint to use, I think. I mean, it's so much better than acrylic. I was actually thinking about this the other day, because I play music as well, and I get a friend of mine's making me a guitar, and he was asking me about lacquer, and on old guitars you used to get I don't know the technical words, but nitro.
He's
something.
Making you a guitar, your friend.
Yeah, yes, he is. Yeah, I mean, he does build guitars, <major. laughs> but he's making me one, and he was asking me about lacquers. Now, it's like you can get the old lacquer they used to use, and one of the reasons that old guitars built up until a certain year sound better is because they use a different type of lacquer, and they changed it to plastic lacquer, to, like, I don't know what it would be, but they changed it, and that is sort of the difference between oil paint and acrylic, in a way, I think.
Right.
It's like, you know, acrylic paint is like plastic, and it looks like plastic. And it's kind of the same with this lacquer for guitars. I was thinking about it. You know, the old one resonates, and it actually changes the colour slightly. That's not just why I use oil paint, but I thought it was a nice analogy.
And actually, colour's something that's really important, I think, in your work. And there's definitely what is very different to what your dad does and what you do, because I've seen both the paintings side by side in the studio, which is why I often associate you both together. But is that your work seems to have this kind of sensitivity to colour, which is quite different to your dad's. And I think it's really interesting, this kind of, recently a lot of the works had this kind of teal and these kind of light blues and things like that. And I think the oil paint, particularly in those colours, is so interesting. Is that something you're aware of?
I've been painting a lot more over lockdown, and I think the colours that you're kind of talking about, kind of, they started to happen a bit more over that time, almost quite pastely in a way.
Yes,
a horrible
pastely
word.
Exactly. No, but I don't know if it is, though, because I think what you're doing with it, it's a really beautiful kind of, yeah, there's a really interesting energy that's happening in the work.
And that, yeah, I think they have like a look, which you seem to pick up on in the studios, they do have a sort of softer kind of energy to a lot of my father's work. My
yes
dad's work. which is funny because it's, I think I'm probably a more softer person.
That's true.
he's quite a spiky man in many ways, in many good ways.
Is he a critic of your work? Is he quite raw with his approvals or disapprovals of your practice?
He's pretty raw with everything, if you've ever met him. he's a fantastic critic, you know. He is genuinely a really good tutor. I'm not just saying that because he's my dad, because he can, to a certain extent, I feel he can kind of understand a direction that I'm sort of trying to go in, because he's done it and can... He's very good at looking things and pointing things out, you know. It'd never be like, you need to do this, you need to do that. It'd be like, have you looked at this? Have you considered this? You know, that white mark there is really drawing my attention, and maybe, you know, maybe it's a problem, I don't know. And Steve Lowe does that, or did, still comes to the studio, but especially a couple of years ago, I used to ask him for a lot of critique. He's a friend of my dad's who runs L13.
Yeah, and Steve's a really great painter in his own right.
Yes.
What's L13?
I can tell you. L13 is a kind of publishing house and exhibition space. So they do exhibitions, and they're based in Farringdon kind of area, not far from where you live, Russ. And and Steve publishes loads of books and makes prints and is incredibly kind of supportive person for many different artists, including like Jimmy Corti and Billy Childish. And there's a whole gang that he's kind of part of. And yeah, he's a brilliant person, but he's also a really great artist in his own right.
Yeah, Steve's great.
Wow. So what other artists are you looking at? Because I can see so many, obviously I see your dad's work in your practice, but then I see like Van Gogh or Van Gogh. I think your dad shouted at me last time when I pronounced it wrong. And now whenever I say Van Gogh, I think of your dad telling me.
Yeah, it's Van Gogh. I love Van Gogh.
Van Gogh, that's it, you just said it right. But then Munch is in there, and then I can see like Paul Arago and Matisse and Freud and Marlene Dumas and Gauguin. And there's so many things, and then your own language, obviously.
One of the artists that I always go back on is Delacroix, one of my all-time favourites. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's probably the most amazing exhibition I've ever seen. I went to see his exhibition in Paris. It must have been like 4 years ago now, or 3 years ago. And it really was like the most amazing, by quite a long way, actually. And I was quite surprised. Just the impact of some of those paintings. You walked in and it was, the first painting was The Massacre at Chios. And it's just like completely mind-blowing. Yeah, wow. For colours, for composition, looking at figures, and also what he says about art is like absolutely in the same way what Van Gogh says about painting. His journal is like amazing.
What does he say?
His journal is great. It's a funny mixture of like his musing on painting and his like teenage angsty struggles, and then as he gets into an older man, you know, his struggles with life and with, you know, oh, my cousin's more attractive than I am, and all the girls fancy him, and all that kind of stuff. and then also talking about these like really fantastic paintings, and you know, I really need to get permission to copy this Velasquez. It's really amazing. And he writes about painting in like a really profound way, which I think is kind of not really spoken about these days. You know, there's a lot of focus on other aspects of art and of painting. You know, the subject or the kind of political act of painting, or the kind of like other political things that kind of go around it. And in that, I think is lost a little bit of like stuff that you kind of get when you read Delacroix, Van Gogh, or these amazing ideas they had about what painting could be, or, you know.
Yeah. So are you talking more about like soul painting, or like, you know, some kind of essence of the human condition or something beyond just more of a storytelling approach?
I'm not sure if I'm talking about either of those things. I think something someone said to me last year, which I thought was really a really nice way of putting it, is like painting or great art should be like poetry. It should like lift you out of the state you're in, or this, or the place you're in.
Yeah.
Like when you read a really amazing author or in a really great book, and you think, God, life is like so much more than this. Or a great poem, and I think painting can do that in a kind of profound way.
Yeah, and they were saying a great authors and great painting can lift you out of the mire, can take you, transport you somewhere else, and it's not snobbery, it's actually, you know, spiritual in some ways.
Yeah, completely. I mean, one of the great things, not to rattle on about what people said, but like, one of the reasons I think Van Gogh painted sunflowers was because he thought it would be amazing for someone that's on a battleship in the middle of the ocean that doesn't have access to real flowers to be able to have the next best thing, which would be like a painting of some, and that would make their life a little bit better, which is
can you imagine if his sunflowers was on a battleship?
Probably would make their life better.
I mean, yeah, it would, yeah.
But you yourself have been painting sort of details, like interior details with flowers. So you've just done clematis recently, and like that seems to be an ongoing theme for you.
I really like painting flowers, yeah. It's a nice break from painting figures and from drawing figures, which I think is really difficult. Drawing flowers is sort of cheating, because it's kind of nowhere near as difficult as drawing figures, I think, you know, because they're so much more fluid in their form, you know. You don't have to actually, you can kind of just make them look a little bit like a flower and they look like a flower. Whereas like an arm, it really does have to look like an arm.
Hack. Yeah. How often do you paint and draw? Are you trying to do it every day?
No, I don't do it every day. Since I've been down here, my father paints once a week, and he goes to the studio once or twice a week. So I go with him and I work then. But if I'm in London, I work a little bit more, maybe 3-4 days I'll go into the studio. But I couldn't go in every day. And to be honest, I probably only have one day of like really good painting a week.
Right, when you're in your flow.
Yeah, because it kind of...
Ips.
Yeah, but it'd be too much to do it all day, every day, I think. I paint quite quickly as well. And if I painted all the time, I'd just paint over stuff. And I try and take my own advice. Like, I'm always telling my friends of mine not to paint over stuff. I think people really often paint over some of their best work.
Right. Wow. Tell us about Slade. What is art school like at Slade now you're about to graduate? What has your experience been like? And is it as kind of exciting and exhilarating when you first get there as I would imagine it to be?
It's a difficult question. Slade is like, I think art school in general is, it's not there to fulfill the requirement which I hoped it was, in that it's not there to teach you how to paint. And I think if you go to art school under the idea that you're going to be taught academic skills, you know, or you're going to be taught how to draw, that the main focus, it seems to me, is around the talking about art, you know, the discussion around it, the seminars, the talking to each other, but you have to be quite self motivated in your drive to like work out how to do stuff. And there are some really, really fantastic tutors at Slade, and that genuinely really care about the students and really want the best for them. And like you can tell that, especially over now, you know, some of the tutors are feel very bad about the situation that we're in. And but it's like, it's that, you know, I think I had a certain expectation of being taught in a way that no one is taught in these days. And I'm very lucky to, I guess, know a few people like my dad, like my old man, that can sort of like give you a bit of guidance in that way. But I don't think art school functions in that way, or it doesn't seem to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's somehow more about the critiques and the kind of thoughts behind work rather than the actual skill to make a work. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll refrain on passing judgment on that. I'll see how it ends up.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So what are your dreams then? Because you this is your life now, right? Going forward, you're 20. You're going to be 21 like next week. This is, you can see yourself doing this for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I really hope so. It's like, honestly, I've been thinking about it more than ever over the last month, because it probably is. I don't know how many months is it till May or whatever till I finish. And it's gonna be my first time out of education since I was like 5 or something, which is insane. I don't know quite how I'm gonna work it out, or quite what you know, but I'm sure it will all work out. Yeah, I'd love to be able to, and I think I will be able to, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's just like me being, I don't know, like I feel like it will all kind of work out in the way that it's meant to work out, and it sort of has.
I feel like it.
Yeah. It sort of has so far. I think I've landed on my feet in this life, you know, and I'm very grateful for all of the
opportunities.
All of the opportunities that are just there.
What are your hopes and dreams though then? Do you have like museums you're like, I would really love to, you know, obviously do a show with Delacroix in France together, like a duo show? Or do you have like, you want to be in this museum, or you'd like to be shown there? Do you have aspirations for where you'd like your work to be shown and seen?
I'd like my work to be shown to people that care about it, and I'd like it to be bought by people that care about it and not bought for any other reason than that. I think that's the only thing you can really ask for, you know, that it's not, because that's the weird thing, like talking about art school, it's like art school is so incredibly left wing, and then it kind of feels like the art market is so incredibly right wing.
Oh, absolutely. The artists are Democrats, and then the buyers are Republicans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like all banking and whatever, you know. I think it'd be great to be able to sell to people, or for people to buy. But I don't really know about museums or anything, you know. I'd just like to be able to do what I want to do in the way that I want to do it, and to be able to not have to work in a bar, or not have to, you know, have a real job.
Is it hard for you to let the paintings like go to new homes? Because like I mentioned before, like I've got one of your paintings, and I know a few of my friends have bought your works, because I've always thought the subject matter of your work is so personal, like either they're self-portraits, or you and your friends, or even your dog Captain. But like that, there's all these kind of very personal moments. How do you feel when you have to let a painting go to a new home?
I'd love to be able to never sell any paintings, but then it's like... You know, I'm in two minds about it. It's like I paint a lot of paintings, and I've got you know, probably 100 paintings in the studio or something that I've done, or probably more, you know, what I've been doing for a long time, well, for 5 years or something.
And
it's better in a way that they're on someone's wall that appreciate them. And it's really useful because, you know, I just bought some more canvas today and spent like, you know, almost... Well, I think I spent about £700 on canvas, and it's like, it's really nice when you can sell a painting and get a bit of money to buy a canvas and live on.
Yeah, and kind of like reinvest back into what you want to make next.
Exactly.
And yeah, it's a feeding system, isn't it? Yeah.
And I think it's better that things go to, you know, as much as I don't like selling paintings, it is really nice when you see one of your paintings on someone's wall. Like a few of my friends have paintings, and you know, it's nice that they enjoy a life of their own and go out into the world and do their thing.
Is painting with oil paint harder than acrylic, or is it just a completely different thing? Because I've always thought with oil paint somehow it needs more skill, or more like it's more like chemistry behind it or something.
I don't know. There is chemistry behind it. I'm not classically trained, but there is definitely stuff like, you know, you don't want to put... I can't actually remember what way it is. I'm pretty sure it's quick drying paint on top of slow drying paint, so you don't want to, because then it will crack. And there's lots of things like that go on. I've got a funny thing I read. I was really into talking about Delacroix. I was really into Jericho when I was on my foundation. I actually did a copy of a little section of Raft of the Medusa, and apparently that's painted on bitumen, because at the time it was like cheaper than black paint. So they thought, oh, we'll use this as a ground. It's painted on bitumen, and it needs to get like taken down every 30 years or something and kind of reapplied, because the bitumen never properly sets. So it's constantly like sagging down. Yeah.
And the bitumen's a bitch. Yes.
Oil paint takes longer to dry, and that probably involves a little bit more like careful thinking, but you know, and it's more expensive and more messy. And, but I'm really bad with my paint. You know, I destroy loads of the pigment by like mixing it with loads of turps and taking it off with rags and kind of messing about with it a bit. But I think I don't know whether it probably is harder, you know, it's probably more daunting as well. I use acrylic, but only really if I'm doing, you know, if I'm like doing like a little study with ink, I'll use white acrylic or something to try and work something out, just because it dries nice and quickly, kind of just like white, mm-hmm. you know, just use it as a white ink.
Interesting. Yeah.
This drawing thing's really interesting because there's the artists that use oil paint really densely on the surface, people like Frank Auerbach, they say that the paintings that have been completed like 40 years ago are still drying when they do so these crazy tests on them within the auction houses. The paint inside the outer casing is still wet because it takes so long, and some of these paintings take like decades to really fully dry out.
Yeah, it is crazy. I mean, there definitely are some, like King's Blue, I think takes forever to dry. I've used that before, and in the winter when it's cold and damp, it's like it'll, you know, will be 6 months before it's like kind of feeling like it's dry if you use a big clump.
Wow.
There's also weird stuff with like I'm not sure in what ones, but I've heard stuff about certain Van Goghs when he was using like kind of, that was right when people started putting paint in tubes, I think, wasn't it, with the impressionists and stuff, like using unstable pigments and like colors completely changing. Like things that you would have used that would have been really vibrant, kind of just dulling over time because the pigments are unstable.
Oh, right. Yeah, and I think Winsor & Newton, who we've been collaborating with, I think they've done a lot of research with scientists to try and make pigments to have a long-lasting, you know, representation of the colour that the artist desired.
Mm.
It's really interesting how it's all developed.
And I think if you mix them with linseed oil and stuff, that kind of yellows them more. But,
right.
Hadi, we ask every guest that comes on two very important questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, you can have any work of art in the world to yourself, you can steal it happily and no one's going to complain, what would it be and why?
It's a really difficult question. I'm actually really bad at answering questions like this. I'm sorry, I'm such a bad recipient for this.
Don't worry.
Would it be a masterpiece by like Delacroix?
Because that's kind of, I think maybe that famous self-portrait that Delacroix did would be a really fantastic to have. Not even because it's like one of his best paintings, just because it's like this is one of the only self-portraits he did. I think that, or maybe like a monk self-portrait. I'm not sure what one though. It's like asking you what your favorite color is. You know, it is such a hard question to answer.
That is what we're going to ask you.
That's
now.
That's what we're going
to
ask you next.
Really?
We ask every guest what's their favourite colour.
My favourite colour. Well, I do have an art. My favourite colour is green. So there you go.
I thought it would be green or teal or blue. Like I knew it's going to be somewhere like that. Because I do feel like there's always a thread in your work of greeny, kind of blue, green. Why green?
Green's my favourite colour just because I've sort of thought about, been asked the question before, and I used to ask it to my parents when I was a kid. And I've just kind of decided that, all right, it's going to have to be something. So it should just be green because I do really like green. But like, it's like, you know,
I've been forced into making that decision.
I have so many favorites. It's like, I don't know. What's your guys' favorite colors?
Mine is blue. Rob's orange.
Orange.
Orange and green. That's a good match.
Yeah.
I only know because I've got orange hair and I'm wearing a green jumper.
Yes, a lot of people who have strawberry blonde, red ginger hair normally wear a lot of green.
I get bought a lot of green jumpers, yeah.
Because it offsets the hair. Amazing. Well, happy birthday for your 21st.
Thank you very much.
What are you working towards? Where can people see your work in the flesh? Do you have any plans in the future? Obviously, you're going to have a graduation show?
I'm going to have a graduate show. I don't have any shows. No, I mean, hopefully we have our graduate show in real life. That's what I'm really, really praying for. You know, I think it's outrageous to put people's graduate shows online. I mean, you've got Instagram for that. I just think it's, you know... So I really hope we have one in person. And no, I don't have any shows. I don't know where people can see my work in life. They can come to the Slade Degree Show if it happens.
And you're on Instagram as well, at Huddy_Hamper. So people can follow you there, and you've got a wide range of your work in progress.
Yeah, I put stuff on Instagram. Yeah. Or you can go around Rob's house.
Exactly. Exactly. Next time you're in Margate.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming
on,
mate. It's been really lovely talking to you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for your questions. I'm sorry I couldn't really answer the what's your favourite painting.
Well, you kind of did, though. It's good.
Thanks so much for asking me.
Yeah, cool. Of course. Well, for everyone listening, so we had Huddy's Instagram there, and Adelaide Demoa is also on Instagram. Do you know her Instagram handle, Rob?
Yeah, she's just Adelaide Demoa, so it's her full name. And then Huddy's is Huddy_Hamper.
Great. And for all images we're talking about today, please check out Instagram, and please check out Winsor & Newton Paint, because they're legendary and their oil paints are the best.
And actually, and, they're on Instagram as well. You can go to @Winsor & Newton and learn more about what they do. Well, yes. Thank you for listening, everyone. We will be back very soon.
Thanks.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.